From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Kurds continue to flee Iraq. On today's Fresh Air, background and opinion on how the Bush administration has distanced itself from the Iraqi civil war. We talk with New York Times reporter Patrick Tyler and Middle East expert Fred Halliday. Also today, we talk with Todd Haynes. He wrote and directed the new movie Poison, the latest work in the controversy over NEA funding of the arts. The Sundance Film Festival gave the movie its top prize, but fundamentalist Christian groups are condemning this movie, whose subject is deviance and transgression. And critic Owen Gleiberman reviews the home video release of a 70s classic, The Last Picture Show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush announced today that the U.S. will begin dropping food and other supplies to refugees and civilians in northern Iraq. The president said that U.S. Air Force transport planes will be used to deliver the aid. He stressed that the aid was prompted only by humanitarian concerns and said the Iraqi government will be expected to permit the effort without interference. The airlift is to begin on Sunday. The president said that the aid will be coordinated with diplomatic efforts by the U.S. and allied nations to provide long-term care for the refugees. The refugees fleeing Iraq appear to be increasingly desperate as they battle food shortages and the hazards of the elements. Hundreds reportedly died last night from exposure. NPR's John Hockenberry reports on the plight of the refugees.
40,000 Kurds are being forced to march across extremely rugged mountain country today to begin an uncertain existence in a wide rocky field, technically inside Iraqi territory. The Kurds, Syrian Christian and ethnic Turks, and other refugees from Iraq are being settled in three camps which will become more or less permanent in the next few days. The policy of the Turkish government appears to be to keep the Kurds and other refugees as close to the Iraqi border as possible. Hundreds are estimated to have died last night from exposure. This afternoon, a child with a frightening blue-yellow tinge of extreme hypothermia was being carried out of the makeshift camp by a frantic man. The Turkish government estimates that 650 Kurds are trying to get into Turkey. They expect only to absorb a little more than 100,000.
NPR's John Hockenberry. Former Senator John Tower was among at least 19 people who were killed today in a plane crash in Georgia. The Texas Republican and his daughter were on a twin-engine commuter flight from Atlanta that crashed and burned at the Brunswick Airport. Tom Olson of member station KERA in Dallas reports on how Tower will be remembered in his home state.
65-year-old John Tower was the dean of Texas Republicans and was largely responsible for introducing two-party politics in the Lone Star State. He served 23 years in the U.S. Senate, chairing the Armed Services Committee before retiring in 1984. President Bush nominated Tower to be his defense secretary in 1989, but his confirmation was rejected by the Senate over controversial allegations about excessive drinking and womanizing. Tower was traveling with his daughter Marion when the twin turboprop commuter aircraft crashed on its way from Atlanta to Brunswick, Georgia. There were no survivors. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Olson in Dallas.
Stock prices were down today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 28 points to close at 2,896.78. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-2 in heavy trading on volume of 187 million shares. This is NPR News. Officials in Peru say that heavy rains are hampering rescue efforts in a northern town where at least 28 people were killed by an earthquake yesterday morning. That quake, measuring 5.8 on the Richter scale, was said to have caused damage to 90% of the houses in a town of about 50,000 people. More than 300 people were reported injured. A second quake with a Richter of 6.1 struck the southern part of the country last night. One person was reported injured in that quake, which was also said to have caused extensive property damage. The space shuttle Atlantis is orbiting the Earth today following a near-perfect launch this morning. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
After a 5-minute delay due to low clouds, Atlantis and the $600 million Gamma Ray Observatory raced into a 280-mile high orbit. The observatory is to be deployed on Sunday morning, and former project manager Jerry Glicksman says the data received should help unlock the mysteries of the universe.
The purpose is to both expand our knowledge of the universe, even to helping to prove or disprove the Big Bang theory of the creation of the universe, and also to help understand the evolution of the Earth, what we might expect in the future.
If everything goes according to plan, the Gamma Ray Observatory will begin gathering data during the last week of April. The 5-day Atlantis mission will end with a landing in the California desert. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
A Florida judge has refused a media request to unseal a police report on an alleged rape at the Kennedy family compound at Palm Beach. Police have claimed that excessive media attention has hampered their investigation. At a news conference today, police did reveal that the suspect in the case is William Kennedy Smith, a nephew of Senator Edward Kennedy. The woman who made the charge said the alleged assault occurred at the Kennedy compound after she met Smith, the senator, and his son at a Palm Beach bar. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In mid-February, President Bush called on the Iraqi military and the Iraqi people to take matters into their own hands and force Saddam Hussein to step aside. First Shiites in the south, then Kurds in the north, began to fight the Iraqi military. But the president says it is not our place to intervene or to protect them against Saddam Hussein's brutal suppression of their rebellion. But today the president authorized an airdrop of $10 million worth of food, blankets, and clothing for Kurdish refugees. Millions of Kurds are fleeing the Iraqi army. Many are trapped at the borders with no place to go. What is our responsibility to the Iraqi people? Earlier today, we put this question to two Middle East experts, Professor Fred Halliday and journalist Patrick Tyler. First, we'll hear from Tyler, a reporter for the New York Times. He reported from Baghdad for the 6 weeks preceding the war. Since then, he's been filing from Washington. I asked him if he's heard any difference between the Bush administration's official and unofficial reasons for staying out of the conflict.
I think unofficially what you hear in slightly sharper tones, Terry, is a very strong reluctance on the part of the Bush administration to get involved in something that there may be no way out of. Getting involved militarily to protect the Kurdish rebellion or the Shiite rebellion in southern Iraq contemplates a significant military involvement by the United States at a time when it has no United Nations mandate to go farther, at a time when it is politically apprehensive about the potential of Iraq splitting apart, and it is somewhat reticent about all of the motives of those who are pushing the most strongly for the United States to take sides in this internal conflict.
Although President Bush urged the Iraqis to overthrow Saddam Hussein, some people are saying what he really wanted was a military coup, not a popular uprising. What the United States wanted was stability, not necessarily democracy. What do you think?
Well, on that point, Terry, that is where many people are questioning the wisdom of the president's tactics in the wake of the military defeat. If the administration wanted to change the government in Baghdad, one has to ask the question, well, how did it intend for that to happen? And therefore, what did the administration do in order to encourage that objective to be met? One thing we saw that it did in public was that it exhorted people to rise up. It's the people of Iraq to change the government, to convince Saddam Hussein to leave. The president also sent some very specific warnings to Baghdad that it better not use chemical weapons against the insurgents who were in the early stages of their rebellion. And then, he kept a very hard proscription against the Iraqi military using any kind of fixed-wing aircraft and toyed with the idea of extending that ban to helicopter gunships in order to protect the insurrection. If that was all part of a strategy to help changed the government, the administration then very quickly came to a crossroads of, well, how do we want to change the government? Do we want to change the government by a popular uprising in which the ethnic groups basically each one grabs for his own piece of Iraq and tears it apart and the central government falls? Or was it an attempt just to use all of this domestic pressure the pressure of uprising to convince the traditional elite, which is a Sunni Muslim minority elite in Baghdad that has always represented the core of power in the country, is to convince that elite class, that ruling class, for it to do something about Saddam Hussein and to convince him to leave, to force him to leave. Instead, I think what you see is somewhat of a backlash here, in which the leadership class sees such a threat to the cohesiveness, the integrity of the country from a general uprising, that group has hung together fairly strongly in the last few weeks in order to first preserve Iraq before even thinking about what kind of government they might want in the future.
Why would the Bush administration see it as being in its best interest to have somebody else from the Sunni ruling class in power as opposed to a more democratic system?
I think it's an assessment that principally comes out of the U.S. intelligence community that Iraq can only be governed in one way, by a fairly harsh, fairly well-controlled, well-organized central government that's based in the Sunni Muslim minority. This is a tradition that has existed in the Middle East since these nations were carved up out of the mandates at the end of World War I. It is a recognition that the region is not ready for democracy, that if you left it to democratic forces, there would be anarchy, chaos, and separatism in countries like Iraq, which have strong ethnic groups and religious-based minorities in a diverse geographical mix that never saw themselves or acted as nation until artificial boundaries were effectively drawn around them and a strong central government with all the apparatus of control was created.
The Kurds are saying that they think they were betrayed, that they were egged on, and then the United States withdrew any support. And from what you're saying, it sounds like they might be justified in feeling betrayed in the sense that there was some amount of support for the rebellion, but the United States didn't want to see the rebellion succeed. It wanted to see a military coup within the country. So there would never be supported enough to actually succeed, and that small amount of support put them in a very dangerous situation.
Well, you've got to keep this in perspective, I think. You have to, and also remember an important little piece of history. George Bush was CIA director when the Nixon and Ford administrations very cynically got involved with supporting the Kurds covertly to help the Shah of Iran put pressure on Saddam Hussein in the mid-1970s over a very bloody border dispute campaign between Iraq and Iran. And the moment that the Shah, that pressure campaign achieved its objective and convinced Saddam Hussein to sign a new border agreement with Iran, with the Shah of Iran, the CIA dumped the Kurds, and of course Baghdad began a brutal campaign of repression. George Bush did not invent that program, but he was CIA director during the course of the support for the Kurds and at the time of the signing of the treaty, the abandonment of the Kurds and the brutal campaign of repression that was launched at that moment by Baghdad to crush that rebellion. Today, we have a situation in which a coalition took action against Iraq with the authority of the United Nations Security Council to eject Iraqi occupation forces from Kuwait. That victory was so complete and so devastating on the Iraqi army that spontaneously insurrections erupted inside Iraq, not just Kurdish insurrection, but Shia insurrection in southern Iraq. But in any event, this was a spontaneous uprising that was not planned, and initially I don't believe, any discussion at high levels in the Bush administration whether to support it or whether not to support it. When it happened, I think they took some steps to nurture it, to protect it, banning any use by Baghdad of chemical weapons, banning any use of fixed-wing aircraft. So your statement of the question, Terry, implies a deliberacy that I don't think was there, and I think the president and the Bush administration at this point is trying to find some middle course out of this in which it's going to take some heavy criticism, no matter which direction it turns, to satisfy some obligation to protect the Kurds, to protect the Shia, but at the same time stay within the mandate of the United Nations and get on with the reconstruction in the area after this war.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Patrick Tyler, a reporter for The New York Times, who has been reporting on the war and the war's aftermath. What about humanitarian aid? Is there a debate now in Washington about what the United States can be doing on a humanitarian level to help the people who are huddled at the borders, at the border of Turkey and unable to get in?
I think the Turks will open that border, Terry. Turkey, don't forget, was an important member of the coalition that undertook this campaign against Iraq. Turkey has its own history with the Kurds. It's not a very pretty one. Turkey had a very bad experience at the end of the Iran-Iraq war when the 100,000 refugees fled across the border, and Turkey ended up holding the bag, as it were, caring and feeding for these 100,000 Kurds who were afraid to go home and without much international assistance. So I think Turkey's initial statement that it would keep the border sealed was probably tactical to make sure that there was an international effort mobilizing to give Turkey some assistance to help these refugees and in bringing them across the border to get some money to pay for the food and the temporary housing, the tents, that they would need to stay there until they could come to terms with whether it was safe to go back to their homes in Iraq.
Earlier this week, you quoted an Iraqi expert named Christine Moss, and she said to you, what we have now in the Middle East is worse than what we had when Iraq was in Kuwait. We still don't have Saddam Hussein out of power, and now we have this deteriorating situation on the frontier between the Persians, the Arabs, and the Turks. Do you agree with what she told you?
I think it's too early to say that that judgment is correct, Terry. I think it's a very interesting point. Christine Moss Helms has been an Iraq scholar for a long time, and she's very smart and very well published on Iraqi affairs and in Islamic and Arab affairs. And I think her view is that basically we may have an extended low-intensity war inside Iraq for a long time, that the army has been so devastated by the Western alliance, the military alliance, that it won't be able to control the whole country all of the time, that it will be able to control the major cities, the key oil-producing facilities, but that there will be banditry and guerrilla warfare in the Iraqi countryside for the indefinite future, and that regional players who have interests in this instability, such as Iran, such as Syria, and maybe even Israel, will play their own cat's paw game in fueling the instability inside Iraq in a way that is not good for everyone's long-term interests in the region.
It wasn't too long ago, it was just a few weeks ago, that the mood seemed pretty jubilant in Washington and the Bush administration because we had won such a quick military win. What is the mood of the administration like now? Can you give us a sense of that from your sources?
Well, I think they're a little bit hunkered down. I think you see the president coming out almost on a daily basis and expressing his frustration and his anger and his disappointment at the carnage that is still going on inside Iraq, and a frustration over feeling with their hearts that they'd like to do something to help with the Kurds, but being told by their heads and by their allies that to do so might just further the instability and lead to the Lebanization or the fracturing of Iraq. Some people disagree with this, but what it all amounts to, when you put it all together, all of this disappointment, all of this frustration, and this policy ambivalence for this, what actually was a very short period of time, is that you already see the charges of moral failure, and that somehow this clean victory that the Allies had won on the battlefield against the Iraqi army has become a soiled and somewhat degraded event in the course of Middle Eastern affairs.
Well, Patrick Tyler, I thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm happy to do it. Thank you.
Patrick Tyler of The New York Times. Coming up, a different point of view on America's policy on the Iraqi uprising. We talk with Professor Fred Halliday. First, a short break. This is Fresh Air. Fred Halliday says the U.S. could have done more to protect Iraqis from Saddam Hussein's brutal suppression of their rebellion. We called Fred Halliday in London. He's a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics, and he's written extensively on the Middle East for The Nation and the Middle East Report. Many Iraqis say President Bush betrayed them by calling for an uprising, then standing by as the rebels were slaughtered. I asked Halliday what he thinks.
Well, there's two aspects to the question. I think one is many people find it difficult to think that the United States has any business becoming involved in supporting opposition movements in Iraq or anywhere else, since they regard U.S. intervention as always pernicious and always self-seeking. They don't want to see it. Now, the policies of the United States are always self-seeking, like those of any other state. But there are cases in which intervention on the side of democratic forces could and would be justified. The United States, very late in the day, swung behind the independence of Namibia, and I'm not against the independence of Namibia, just because the United States' reasons for doing that might have been self-seeking. Moreover, there are classic cases in the post-war period of what one could call humanitarian intervention. I mean, the Indian invasion of East Pakistan in 1971 in support of the independence of Bangladesh was a clear case of that, even though India's motives were obviously self-seeking. So I think that you've got to get to the heart of the matter is, can people who, for very good reasons, are against 95% of all forms of U.S. intervention, except there might be 5% where this intervention was justified. I happen to think it is. The second thing is, did they make commitments to the Kurds? Yes. Bush's statement in mid-February, appealing to the Iraqi people to rise up, was a green light to people to do something. Moreover, the United States' clear preference for removal of Saddam Hussein was a green light. It was a form of encouragement. You cannot fire off a missile and then say you're not responsible for where it lands. And this is, in effect, is what they've done. So I think they should have done something, and there are a number of things they could have done short of sending troops into Iraq.
Suggest.
They could have simply said that if Saddam Hussein moved artillery, moved tanks, moved helicopters, moved significant numbers of troops into Kurdistan a week or 10 days ago, then the United States would bomb those forces. In other words, they would have issued a threat to Saddam, which in the light of what had just happened in Kuwait, he would have taken very seriously indeed, which would simply have, in effect, frozen the situation and allowed the Kurds to consolidate the situation. At the same time, you could have provided substantial assistance to the Kurds in form of food, because the Iraqis would have blockaded the area, in the form of medical supplies, in the form of diplomatic encouragement, and, frankly, in terms of arms. So without actually General Schwarzkopf marching on Baghdad, you could have arrested, stopped Saddam's counterattack against the Kurds, and secondly, allowed the Kurds to build up their strength. And let's be clear about it, the Kurds are acting in liaison with other democratic forces inside Iraq. So there's a lot that could have been done short of actually simply occupying the whole of Iraq. Now, people say, well, this is against the UN Charter. I agree that it's not something that can be done under the terms of the UN Charter, but it's something which is perfectly justified in terms of broader arguments of humanitarian intervention.
Do you think that the Allies want to see a military coup in Iraq, but not a popular uprising?
The United States has been calling for a military coup for some time. The CIA-backed opposition radio station, Voice of Free Iraq, has been appealing to the Iraqi army to rise up. This is not the hidden agenda, but the not 100% formal agenda. It was hoped it would happen before the war began on the 15th of January, then it would happen before the start of the ground war. It didn't happen, but this is still what they're hoping. And this is the goal of the longer-term strategy they're now pursuing, which is to deny Iraq the wherewithal to rebuild its armed forces. The military sanctions and the industrial production-related sanctions to stop Iraq from rebuilding its forces and all these other things about getting rid of chemical and nuclear weapons and so forth and artillery and all the rest of it, all of that is part of an attempt to put pressure on the Iraqi army, saying you can only rebuild yourselves if you get rid of Saddam and those around him. So that is a clear goal, there's no doubt about it. And they would prefer to see some kind of pro-Western military coup or military regime of the kind they've had in Pakistan for years, they've had on and off in Turkey, to seeing a non-military regime emerge.
George Bush has said that the United States, you know, has no role interfering in another country's civil war. Yet Bush used to be the head of the CIA, and everybody knows that the CIA has intervened in civil wars of other countries in the past. So do you find that kind of statement basically hypocritical because of America's past history?
Well, it's nonsense in the sense that any form of influence of another country's politics, domestic or international, is a form of interference. And the question is not do you or do you not interfere, but to what purpose, on the basis of what criteria? And the first criterion is very simple. Is what you're doing one that commands support within the country or not? If you attack a country where the government is a democratic one and has overwhelming popular support, then clearly what you're doing is wrong. If, on the other hand, you assist the people in that country who want to get rid of their oppressive government and encourage them by diplomatic, economic, humanitarian aid, and for that matter financial means to do so, then that is construed in terms of the key criterion something that one can support. After all, nobody objects to financial aid or military aid being sent to the guerrillas in South Africa who are opposed to the South African government, unless you are a complete pacifist, which is another point, but most people aren't arguing in those terms. And I think that the issue is therefore not do you or do not intervene, but do you or do you not intervene on the right side? Now, you can get into a long argument about what the right side is, but that is the core of the issue. You had the same thing in Central America. Everybody said, oh, the Americans are intervening against the Sandinistas. No one should intervene. And then the Sandinistas would say, look, we're against American intervention, but we support our struggling brothers and sisters in El Salvador. The key issue is, on whose side are you? Are you on the side of the people who are trying to get a legitimate government overthrown, which is what the United States is trying to do in Nicaragua, or are you trying to overthrow a tyrannical government, which is what was happening in the case of El Salvador? And I think that is the key issue. And if you pin it only on the question of non-intervention, you're living in cloud cuckoo land.
Do you think that the Allies had any idea that the kind of uprising and the kind of slaughter that we're seeing now, the huge number of refugees, would take place as a result of the war?
I don't think that Bush or anyone else in the West looked at the political consequences of a war while the war was going on, let alone before it began. They hoped that some miraculous solution would come about through either killing Saddam Hussein with a cruise missile hitting him or by a coup. I mean, those were the two hopes, but it didn't happen that way. Beyond that, they just didn't know. And what they thought was, well, we'll get on with the fighting. We won't think about what's going to happen afterwards. They didn't think. And in particular, they were not prepared for the uprising and what would have been involved in not just the military support of it, which is pretty straightforward, but the diplomatic support of it. I think another particular blind spot was a failure to see the great interest and potential role of Iran, so that when Iran did come to play a role, when the Iraqi planes went there and when the Iranians started to support the uprising in the south, this created panic for a while in Saudi Arabia and in the West, and people said we must have anything to do with this opposition because the Iranians are backing it. The fact is, the Iran that is backing the opposition is not the Iran of Ayatollah Khomeini, and this Iran wants to play a role in the future political system in the Middle East. It has a legitimate voice to be heard on regional matters and also on Iraqi matters, where a lot of people look to Iran with some sympathy.
Fred Halliday is a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. He spoke to us from London. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new movie Poison is about deviance and transgression. This trilogy spoofs 50s horror films, offers a mock documentary about a boy who killed his father, and a lyrical but brutal story about the sexual obsession of a prisoner for his fellow inmate. It won the top prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It's also at the center of the latest controversy over government funding of the arts. Coming up, we talk with the filmmaker, Todd Haynes. Also, critic Owen Gleiberman has an appreciation of the 1971 film, The Last Picture Show. It just came out on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has ordered U.S. military airplanes to airdrop food, blankets, and clothing to Kurdish refugees in northern Iraq. Thousands of Kurds have fled to the mountains bordering Turkey to escape the Iraqi army, which crushed their uprising. There are now reports that Iraq is shelling Kurdish refugees who are fleeing that country. Jane Howard of the BBC says that refugees are flooding into Turkey, saying that they fear Iraqi troops behind them.
The Turkish government has insisted that it can't throw open its borders because it simply can't cope alone with an influx of this magnitude. But the massive wave of humanity has continued to press against the border, and the Kurds are now being allowed to camp just inside Turkey. Their desperation stems from the fear of the Iraqi troops behind them. Turkish Foreign Ministry sources said they had reports that the Iraqis were shelling the escaping refugees with artillery and mortars. Some had landed near the border. It's a difficult situation to control, and Turkey's Anatolia News Agency reported that 5,000 people tried to push their way further in. The security forces opened fire into the air. A minister, Mr. Fethi Dinçerler, visiting the region, appealed to the refugees to stay on the border line and not to push forwards.
Jane Howard of the BBC. A commuter plane with former Senator John Tower on board crashed this afternoon in Georgia, killing all on board. There were over 20 people on the airplane, including Tower's daughter Marion and astronaut Manley Sonny Carter and his wife. The National Transportation Safety Board has held its first news briefing on yesterday's crash that killed Senator John Hines and six others. Jeff Winokur of member station WRTI in Philadelphia has more.
Speaking in front of the crash site, Susan Coughlin, the vice chairman for the NTSB, says the probe will focus on communications between the plane and the helicopter.
Don't know that they had air-to-air communication. That's one of the things that we're going to be looking at when we read out the cockpit voice recorder from the Bell helicopter. We do know, obviously, that these two planes had air-to-ground because they were communicating with the tower.
Coughlin added that the two aircrafts were not required to have voice recorder boxes.
It is not a requirement that either of these aircraft be equipped with cockpit voice recorders or flight data recorders, but this Bell helicopter was equipped with a cockpit voice recorder.
The investigation into the crash could take up to 9 months to complete. For National Public Radio, I'm Jeffrey Winokur in Philadelphia.
In the most violent of several anti-Iraqi protests today, demonstrators threw stones at the Iraqi consulate in Istanbul. Gunfire reportedly from the compound killed two of the demonstrators. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 28 points to close at 2,896.78 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. NPR's Wendy Kaufman is reporting that Los Angeles Police Chief Daryl Gates is expected back at his post as early as Monday. Yesterday, Gates was placed on administrative leave by the Civilian Police Commission. But today, the City Council, angered by the commission's action, worked out a settlement to reinstate the chief. In New York City, the UN Security Council has condemned Iraq's repression of the Kurds and called for an end to atrocities. The vote was 10-3 in favor of the measure. The Soviet Union and China, both permanent members of the Council who have veto power, abstained. The Council chose to vote in spite of a last-minute effort to block the session by Iraq's UN ambassador, who said that his country would accept a UN fact-finding mission. In Peru, the official death toll in last night's earthquake now stands at 28, with over 300 people injured. The extent of the damage has been clear as rescue workers report back from the earthquake area deep in the nation's northern region. Mike DeMott reports from Lima.
The quake struck shortly before 11:30 last night and measured 6.2 on the Richter scale. The epicenter was near Moyobamba, a jungle town some 415 miles due north of Lima. Officials say the region was rocked by several aftershocks, including one shortly after noon today that measured 4.7 on the Richter scale. Civil defense authorities say a heavy rain in the region is slowing down rescue efforts and making it hard to gauge the extent of the damage. Officials say medical personnel are being flown to the area as weather permits. Emergency supplies called for include medicine, tents, blankets, and sleeping bags. Electric power and telephone service for much of the region has been interrupted, and radios are being used to maintain communication and coordinate the relief efforts. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike DeMott in Lima.
The Coast Guard has picked up more than 100 Haitians stranded in their fishing vessel without food and water. The refugees had been stranded for 5 days. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The Sundance Festival gave it thumbs up, but conservative Christian lobby groups are giving it a thumbs down. The film is Poison. It won the top prize at the 1991 Sundance Film Festival. Now it's the latest focus of controversy surrounding NEA funding of the arts. The Reverend Donald Wildman of the American Family Association of Tupelo, Mississippi, condemned Poison for scenes he described as explicit pornography. And the Reverend Pat Robertson's Christian Coalition demanded that the head of the National Endowment for the Arts resign because his agency helped fund the film. My guest is the writer and director of the film, Todd Haynes. Poison is a movie about deviance and transgression. There are three separate interwoven stories. The section titled Homo is inspired by the writings of Jean Genet. Hero is done in the style of a documentary, and Horror is a spoof of 1950s horror films. In Horror, a scientist discovers the hormone at the root of the sex drive. He accidentally drinks the potion and is transformed into a leper with oozing, crusty skin. This is the scene where he first discovers the sex drive hormone.
That's it. Putrefactive condensation sustained, allowing molecular coagulation by producing biomagnetic gas. I did it.
Dr. Graves?
Yes, I'm Dr. Graves, and I've just captured the sex drive.
Oh, that's marvelous. It means the molecular coagulation theory holds true.
Molecular coag... How do you know that? Who are you?
I'm Dr. Olson.
Todd Haynes, why did you want to use this send-up of 50s horror films to explore the theme of deviance?
Well, in the horror section, I was very self-consciously trying to construct a story that we associate as a very, you know, popular genre. And in this way, I was really saying this is society speaking to us about deviance and sort of trying to find its appropriate place. I was really struck when I was looking back at those films from the late 50s, early 60s, at how incredibly moralistic they were, and often were sort of thinly disguised constructs for dealing with social problems of the time, such as, you know, the threat of communism or juvenile delinquency or UFOs or whatever was sort of upsetting the status quo at that period. And I found that what these narratives often would do was both sort of explore and the excitement of that deviance or that threat, but very safely put it in its place at the end. And it reminded me a great deal of the way AIDS was being depicted by media, both journalistically and in narratives during, you know, this whole past decade.
Let me play a clip from the final part of the trilogy. This is the part of the trilogy that I think is closest to deriving from Jean Genet.
Right.
And this is about a man in prison who becomes sexually obsessed with a new inmate. And this is a clip from this man's early days in prison when he's still a young man.
By the time I was 16 years old, I was notorious as a kid with a terrific knack for theft. Foster homes would no longer take me, and I was sent to the boys' reformatory of Baton. There, in the counterfeit world of men among men, I found my true family. At Baton, I was astounded by the discovery that each male had a male of his own, and that the world of force and manly beauty loved in that way within itself, from link to link.
The other parts of the trilogy are kind of funny in their own way. They're parodies. This is the part that's very serious. It's the part that's done with the most lyricism, although it's the one that's most about brutal love and about a life shut off in prison. Tell me what you're getting at with this part of the trilogy.
Well, unlike the first two stories, as you point out, the homo section, as it's subtitled in the credits, is the first story that sets out from the beginning. It comes directly from the point of view of the person who's been ousted by his society, and the voiceover narration the example that you just played runs throughout that story. So we're much more involved with the subjectivity of somebody who's really on the outside. It's a very, very different perspective. And I really wanted to, explore some homosexual love that's under some very strict barriers and watch the ways that it comes out. But what was important to me was to construct a story where I think the desire between the two men is something that is accessible and something that one invests in, whether or not they're a gay viewer or a straight viewer or whatever, that there's something very powerful and liberating about that desire. But the conditions in which that desire exists in prison and fully restricted environment forces that out in ways that are violent and brutal. And again, I'm speaking, I think about conditions that we all experience, again, whether we're gay or not, where sometimes desire or love comes out in ways that are painful, and that if the world was different, then maybe it would come out in different ways.
My guest is Todd Haynes. His new film, Poison, won the top prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is filmmaker Todd Haynes. What was the effect that Jean Genet had on you when you first read him?
I was first just struck with his lyricism, the quality of his writing, of his prose.
And we should say here that he spends a lot of time in prison himself.
Yes.
And his writing has that kind of lyrical brutality that you're getting at in the movie.
Yeah, definitely. And I should say that Poison, I think, is inspired more by Genet's novels, which are markedly different, I think, in their subject matter and in their style than his plays. And in some ways, he's more well-known for his plays that he wrote after he was out of prison. But I think in many ways, Genet the figure and his very much his political position as a gay man was probably the thing that inspired me the most throughout the making of this film. He always, to me, stood as a very extreme position of negation, of one in which, he rejected the world or tried as fully to reject the world as he possibly could, and was never interested or invested in an identity as a gay person where you were trying to find your sort of niche in society and an accepted place where society would embrace you and give you its little corner like everybody else. I think what was fundamentally transgressive about homosexuality was what interested Genet in it the most and what he really stood for. And I find that to be a really important position to remember, especially in the wake of the AIDS epidemic, when a very defensive and sort of fearful position among gay people was being, expressed. And that just made me feel terrible that people would have to feel like we have to clean up our act and not be threatening and not be, not be what we are in some ways, which is definitely, a threat to the status quo, something very, very different from the basic laws and rules that we're raised in this society. And I think Genet really, stood up for that, for what was different about being gay.
It's the part of the story that we're talking about now, the part directly inspired by Genet, the part you've called homo, that's been most controversial. Donald Wildman of the American Family Association of Tupelo, Mississippi, has condemned your movie because it quote, includes explicit porno scenes of homosexuals involved in anal sex, unquote. Did I miss something? There didn't seem to be anything really explicit there. I mean, there is a scene of two men having sex, and you see them from the waist up. And as I recall, they're wearing shirts.
Yeah. No, it's completely inaccurate. And he admits that he has never seen the film, and he's basing his allocations on a Variety review of the film, which, although it was a very positive review, also kind of misrepresented the way the sex is depicted in Poison and made it sound a lot more dangerous and hardcore than it is. It doesn't even approach the kind of scenes that we see typically in R-rated films out of Hollywood.
Has it been, on some level, for you interesting to think about what Donald Wildman would experience if he actually did see your movie? I mean, this is a movie, that identifies with marginalization and with deviance, which is exactly the opposite of what he stands for.
Yeah.
It's really not a mainstream movie
at all.
If it wasn't for this controversy, very few people would even know about the movie, I think. So what do you think about when you think about the chances of him actually seeing your film?
Well, the fact that Jesse Helms went to see it at a press screening.
Oh, he did.
At a screening for congressmen and senators last week, or I think it was the beginning of this week in Washington, and other such people from various fundamentalist groups, Baptist-related groups, have seen the film. And there's been a sort of regular reportage in the Washington Times about it, amusing reactions, such as one woman saw the film and claimed that it was so dangerous and disturbing. I think it's the same person who said the film is dangerous because it's so artistic, that it's the fact that it's made with such an artistry makes it extremely dangerous. But I think the same woman said she felt like bathing in Clorox after she saw the film. So, yes, these are not the kinds of people that I think the film is really in some ways, it's precisely the people the film is speaking to. But in other ways, I think stylistically and formally it's really not intended for that audience. So the controversy that has certainly made the film, like in certain circles, headline news, which we never, ever anticipated, I think is somewhat of a mixed blessing. Definitely more people will see the film and hear about it. But many people for whom the film was really not made will be looking at it under very sort of with a very specific thing in mind,
As we've described the controversial scene of the two men having sex. I mean, you don't see anything explicit at all. You made a decision to do it that way. I mean, you could have shown a lot more than you did. Obviously, you didn't want to, and I'm curious to hear why.
Well, that particular scene, which is a rape scene toward the end of the film, is I think it's a disturbing and complicated scene, and I think what's really happening is happening on their faces. I mean, that's really what's going on in the scene is in the faces of the two actors and really powerful performances. You don't need to see anything more. It's all there. And I think sometimes doing a simpler thing is stronger and more effective. There are scenes where you see other scenes, a flashback scene in the childhood reformatory where you see two boys engaged in sex and you see someone's exposed rear on top of another boy. And, it's sexier, the scene where the two inmates are sleeping next to each other and one of them is sort of exploring the other. It's sexy, and we didn't really hold back. And I think that it's not at all pornographic in any way. But I wanted to have it be arousing and exciting and maybe something that you don't usually see. But I never felt that we were holding back or that we were making tasteful choices. I've had to use that kind of horrible word now to redeem the film, here and there. But I it wasn't a criteria that we imposed on ourselves at all when we were doing it.
One of the scenes, in a way, that I think you've made the most erotic is where one man is showing another man his scars, scars on his chest.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's a really, really erotic and beautiful scene. And the two performances I think would carry it. It's really, sometimes just an actor can be erotic in his eyes. There's ways that it doesn't have to be, graphic to turn you on. There's ways that withholding that is even more powerful.
You obviously grew up watching a lot of genre movies and probably watching a lot of television.
Right.
Which is, for the most part, very, very mainstream. I'm wondering if you, when you were young, found a literature that spoke to the kind of marginalization that I imagine at some point of your life you felt yourself.
Well, actually, I think you always see that in the mainstream. I mean, I think I found incidents of marginalization or subversion or transgression in mainstream work, and I think it's always there. It's like always sort of the shadow beneath the status quo or the mainstream position. Hitchcock is an amazing example of someone who is incredibly popular and is a household word, but his films are incredibly complex and at times incredibly perverse. And the sort of positions that I think he puts his viewers through as you watch a Hitchcock film are often incredibly subversive.
You mean because you find yourself identifying with the killer and trying to figure out how to make this body die?
Yeah, or just complicit in the whole what is ultimately criminal about even watching, about looking, about seeing things that you're not supposed to see, or how you're ultimately made guilty, or you're a participant in some sort of guilt just by nature of watching. And sitting in the dark theater watching this film becomes a sort of second metaphor for that whole process, let alone the person who's in the film watching a woman or watching a criminal act and ultimately getting involved in it. I think Hitchcock loved to, his central protagonists are always these people who are accidentally stumble into something that all of a sudden they become guilty for when they really are innocent. And it's almost like just by nature of looking or just by nature of experiencing the world, we are made complicit in it. And, I think that's what you do when you watch a movie.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Todd Haynes' new film, Poison, has just opened in New York, and it will open in the rest of the country throughout the spring and summer. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on the situation of the Kurdish refugees?
Terry, we're talking to John Hockenberry, who is describing what he sees on the border in Turkey, to a Kurdish American who visited with the State Department officials yesterday, to American soldiers who are watching the effects of the civil war in Iraq on the people there, to American politicians too, who are telling us what they think this country ought to do. And we've gone back to Warren, Virginia, to see what that particular group of the American people think we ought to be doing about the Kurdish refugees. And we continue with our series on the American family, talking about foster children.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Peter Bogdanovich's film The Last Picture Show is 20 years old this year. It's set in small-town Texas in the early 50s. What they didn't have back then was home video, but we do, and The Last Picture Show has finally been released on video. Owen Gleiberman has a review.
The early 70s marked an astonishing renaissance in American movies. In the space of 1 or 2 years, such revolutionary talents as Robert Altman and Martin Scorsese seemed to explode the boundaries of what movies could be. These were the first post-counterculture directors, and in films like McCabe and Mrs. Miller and Mean Streets, they made the darkest undercurrents of American experience come thrillingly alive. As a director, Peter Bogdanovich is never going to be in their class. Yet his best movie, The Last Picture Show, conveys that same early 70s sense of alienation made gripping. In many ways, The Last Picture Show is a classic small-town soap opera. What distinguishes the movie is its dazzling bleakness and candor. Imagine Peyton Place remade by Ingmar Bergman, and you'll have a pretty good idea. The cast includes Jeff Bridges as a gentleman jock, Sybil Shepherd as his tease of a girlfriend, and Ellen Burstyn as Shepherd's boozing mom. Timothy Bottoms plays the young, wayward hero, who's so achingly lonely he falls into an affair with a housewife twice his age, brilliantly played by Cloris Leachman. Most of these actors were unknown at the time. There's barely a star turn in the entire movie, and that's part of what makes The Last Picture Show feel so authentic. Bogdanovich puts the sexual desperation of his characters right up on screen, as in this scene where Cloris Leachman reacts to the fact that Bottoms has thrown her over for Sybil Shepherd.
What am I doing apologizing to you? Why am I always apologizing to you, you little bastard? 3 months I've been apologizing
apologizing to you without you even being here. I haven't done anything wrong. Why can't I quit apologizing? You're the one ought to be sorry. I wouldn't still be in my bathroom if it hadn't been for you. I had my clothes on hours ago. You're the one made me quit caring if I got dressed or not.
In some ways, the last picture show anticipated the recent fascination with the iconography of the 1950s. The film was justly celebrated for its black-and-white cinematography. Even now, after so many movies have exploited this retro device, the dusty main street of Anarene, Texas seems chilling in its pre-rock-and-roll desolation. In this single film, Bogdanovich proved himself a master of mood. The songs by Hank Williams and Eddie Arnold aren't blasted all over the soundtrack. They drift out in bits and pieces from tinny jukeboxes, and so they never quite ease the loneliness that threatens to engulf everyone on screen. The atmosphere is sometimes more convincing than the story. Western veteran Ben Johnson plays the local entrepreneur whose old-fashioned cowboy heroism is meant to hold the town together. The trouble is, he's weighted down with too much symbolic baggage. This is exactly the sort of old Hollywood device the last picture show mostly transcends. Bogdanovich never has come close to equaling this movie, certainly not in his disastrous sequel, Texasville. Still, for one moment back in 1971, he seemed a true artist. The Last Picture Show isn't quite a great film, but it's enough to make you long for an era when mainstream movies were this down-to-earth and this honest.
Owen Glauberman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Roberta Shurrock and Sue Spoland. Research assistants from Sue Labadie, Ellen Silva, and Tracy Hildebrandt. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Polish filmmaker Piotr Bikant. He made several documentaries on the Solidarity movement. His latest film is about Poland's first year as a democracy. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.